I look back on those dark days. I look back on those days when I was on an air mattress. I look at 2018 when me and my daughter was on an air mattress together. I look at the days when I slept in the van door, and I say everything I've been through is preparing me for something great. And so now that I'm here, I'm like, yeah, like I can look back at those situations and be like, yo, that prepared me for this. So where we are today is a byproduct of what we've done in the past. So if you want to change your future, then you got to change where you're at right now. And I think that's digging deep in yourself. There's no magic pill you can take that make this go away. Right? Like it's a day by day grind. You eat an elephant one bite at a time. So it's every day you just show up for yourself and you just demand more yourself than anybody else's expectation can ever be.
I'm Doug Bopes, personal trainer, best-selling author, and entrepreneur, and I'm on a mission to help others become the best version of themselves. So I'd like to welcome you to the Adversity Advantage podcast, where we will help you use obstacles, failures, and setbacks to give you that edge needed for success. I'll be interviewing people from all walks of life on how they overcame trials and turned them into triumphs. So please, sit back, relax, and get ready to be absolutely blown away by some of the wisdom and stories you're about to hear. Welcome back to another episode of The Adversity Advantage. I'm your host, Doug Bopst, and today's guest is Leon Howard, also known as the Wall Street Trapper. Leon is a New Orleans native who has become a renowned wealth-building expert. Having grown up on the streets, he knows firsthand the challenges and pitfalls that come with it. During his 10-year prison sentence for involvement in criminal activities, Leon discovered the power of the stock market and was able to change the entire trajectory of his life for the better with it. Through his company, From the Trap to Wall Street, Leon offers a wide range of resources, including courses, ebooks, and access to a private members-only group where he simplifies the process of wealth creation and normalizes generational wealth for the Black community through investing in the stock market. With a community of over 1 million trappers, Leon's mission is to educate and empower others to take control of their financial futures. He believes that everyone should have access to financial education and is dedicated to breaking down the barriers that prevent people from entering the world of investing and building wealth one share at a time. Today on the show, we discuss how growing up in a chaotic environment can have a significant impact on a person's mindset and choices, why exposure to different opportunities and role models can make such a big difference in steering someone away from a life of crime, why changing your mindset and perspective is so important for personal growth and transformation, why changing your outlook on life can make a massive difference that can help you shift to make better decisions for your life, why seeking therapy and addressing past trauma is so important for personal growth and healing, why you must take responsibility and shift your mindset in order to break free from negative patterns, and how being a parent really helped Leon take his transformation to the next level, and so much more. So let's get this conversation going and welcome Leon Howard to the Adversity Advantage podcast. Trap, welcome to the podcast.
Man, I appreciate you for having me, family.
You got it, man. I'm excited to dive into your story. I think a good place to start is I know you got sentenced to 10 years in prison when you were 16 years old, tried as an adult. But I would love for you to talk about your life before that, because I know that you had a very chaotic childhood. I believe your mom was shot when you were like 9 or 10 years old, and you saw that. So talk about as in depth as you possibly can what childhood was like for you.
Man, childhood was cool. Just like the typical like New Orleans, inner city, you know, youth childhood. Whereas, you know, we saw crime a lot. But I also normalized it because that's what it was. My grandmother was loving. My mom's was, you know, loving. But I think my mom had a different outlook on life because of the harshness of New Orleans at that time. And her perspective simply was, if anybody going to teach me the game, I'm going to teach it to them. And I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Like, I remember her saying that verbatim to my grandmother. But after seeing my mama get shot, I think life kind of took a shift for me as far as mentally and emotionally, because at that point, I kind of thought in my mind that that would probably be my fate as well, simply because you hear the gunshots all the time and you're surrounded by so many people that's losing family members. But then to see my moms get shot, I think that kind of embedded a certain mindset in me. But life before that, I mean, at that time we lived in a spot where our house was on a corner. They had a graveyard on one side and a park on the other side of the street. And so I remember really just playing like hide and go seek and it and football in a graveyard. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes. So that was kind of in essence my life. And then you know, my grandmother passed away, my mom goes to jail, and then that kind of sent me on this other trajectory in life where whatever hope I did have on being something different, evolving into something different, that kind of went down a drain because then I went to survival mode.
What did your mom go to jail for?
So my mom went to jail for drugs. They kicked her door in and they got, you know, cool little amount of drugs out of her house. And they wanted her to tell on who she got the drugs from, who she was getting drugs from, and she didn't. And I remember my mom telling me at one time, so we was young, when I was young, me and my mom used to love this movie called South Central.
That's a great movie.
Yeah. We used to love this movie. So I remember me and my mama used to always be like, dudes till we die. We used to always say that to each other, right? I remember her telling me, this game come with consequences. And like, if you're going to play the game, you got to be willing to suffer the consequences. And so, you know, she's still solid. She wound up taking a 5-year charge. And I remember, you know, me having to go to prison to see her buying tennis shoes so we can swap out tennis shoes because we wore the same size when I was young. So that was kind of like the stuff I was doing at a young age, you know. And to me, that was my way of holding my mama down. You know what I'm saying? Going to buy new tennis shoes, swapping them out with her in the visitation room. But then we had a turn of events. So my mama was writing one woman that she was dealing with and another woman that she was dating, and the letters got mixed up. When the letters got mixed up, the woman who I was living with, which was the woman she was dealing with before I went to prison, she put me out. She was just like, yo, your mama won't play silly games, then it's the consequences behind it. And so at 13, I end up homeless because of that. And it wasn't because my family didn't want to take me in, but that's a whole nother, you know what I'm saying?
So what was life like at 13 being homeless? Like, what was the day-to-day like for you?
Well, first of all, I remember, so the woman she was dealing with at the time, she was still hustling. So I was like, I couldn't beg her to, you know, one thing my mama taught me was never beg nobody for nothing. You know what I'm saying? Like, so I remember just saying to myself, all right, cool. And I remember asking her to just give me one more day. And she was like, all right, cool. So I remember she used to sell drugs too. So I remember like taking maybe like $600 worth of drugs from her. And then I left in the middle of the night and I went to Mid-City where my aunt was living at. And I remember going there, but she was somewhere else or not to be found. So I remember like, all right, this is going to be where I'm going to be. This is where I'm going to be at. So while I was in that area, they had like a abandoned house on a corner. Well, they had a few abandoned houses, but in New Orleans, they got like what's called duplexes. And so it was a double house, but it was abandoned. And so I remember going to the thrift store right up front where I was from. And I remember buying this dog house. I remember buying a dog house and a sleeping bag. And I remember for the longest, I just slept inside the abandoned house, in the dog house, in the sleeping bag. It was one of the, it wasn't just a regular dog house though, but it was like an igloo almost. And I remember just being like, yo, this is where I'm gonna camp at. And so I stayed up for months, just going to the thrift store, getting clothes from the thrift store, because they had a thrift store in the corner, you know, hustling. My mama taught me how to hustle early. So it was hustling, it was going to the Burger King, which is right there. I would go to the Burger King and brush my teeth. I'll go to somebody's little water spout on the side of their crib and, you know, wash off right quick. But I would get everything from the thrift store. The thrift store was where I got everything from. And then they had a Nike factory not far from me. So if I needed some tennis shoes, I would go there. But it was just simple. I was scared, but, you know, that didn't kind of get you nowhere. So then I started, like, just really locking in with the OGs, and they kind of like took me under their wing as far as just teaching me how the streets go, how to survive, being a runner from them, scoring 2-for-1s, scoring flippers, just to keep money in my pocket. Shooting dice was one of my favorite hobbies in that area on trying to survive. So that was just kind of my life between 13, 14, and then my auntie would come back in town. But I still would stay between her and the abandoned house because she was still on drugs and the guy she was dating was like an alcoholic, and then he had sons, so I would be fighting him all the time. So that was kind of my life. Then about 14, almost 15, I found out that the landlord where my aunt was living at, they lived in a duplex too. She was on drugs. And so I got my first trap house because I would give her drugs for rent. And so then I stayed in a trap house, but I ain't had nothing up. I bought me a mattress from the Goodwill. And that was kind of just my life for a while. Maybe like around late 15, I went to Delaware by my uncle, but I only stayed out there for 60 days because my uncle, I got in so much trouble out there. And then he had to send me back home. So shoot, that was my life, man. And it was normal. It wasn't like, I didn't feel like I was like left out. You know what I'm saying? Like I was still going to school. I don't know, I just adapted and I adapted fast, man. You know, and I attribute that to my mom, even though she may seem like, it may seem like she left me to abandon, but it was survival mode what had been in me, man. You don't get scared of survival. You just, it's necessary.
I'm curious, did you have any kind of emotions? Why is my life like this? And people who don't live in the city that I'm living in, their life is better. Was there anything like that? Or you didn't have time to be angry or anything?
No, I think, you know, I remember going through a phase in my life where I was kind of mad at God. A friend of mine who worked with me right now, he my engineer. I remember telling him at a young age, you know, we was in school one day, and he was like, bro, you seem dark, bro. Because I never really told nobody what I had going on. I was just like, man, I don't rock with God. I said something different. I would never say it now, but I was like, man, I don't rock with God, man. Ain't no God, man. Like, but I remember my rebellion was because I just was like, how could I, you know, I ain't do nothing. You know what I'm saying? Like, why am I in this situation? Why am I living like this? So it was a lot of anger. It was a lot of, I was real dark. I remember being, violence was kind of an easy way for me to release that anger. I remember being just emotionally crying, thinking like nobody ain't love me. Like why my family couldn't take me in at the time. You know, I had a lot of feelings going through that, man. And I think even now, it's good that I'm in therapy because now I learned how to cope with it for so long and I never knew how to address it. So I think now, yeah, it was a lot of anger, a lot of emotion, a lot of sadness, but at the same time, partially, you don't have time to really sit in it because you got to get to it. I learned early on that nobody ain't come and save me.
And as you know, I interviewed Jeezy and I've been just talking to you and hearing your story. And it's like so much of what you did as a kid, it's just about survival. Like, it's not like you chose that lifestyle. That lifestyle really kind of chooses you in a way. You mentioned people in your family were living the same lifestyle, same with Jeezy. But did you like have any other aspirations like as a kid? Like, did you ever think to yourself, man, I wish I wasn't in the street life. I wish I was doing blank. Or were you just so convinced that you were going to be, you know, engaging in the street life forever?
No. So I was in a band because that's a big thing in New Orleans. Like just being in a band. And I remember all my homies, I was like, yo, I'm going to go to college. You know, I'm going to be in a band with them. And, you know, I ain't think too far, but I just knew for sure, like that was my life. And I still tried to hold on to it. But then, you know, as you learn, as you get older, you realize like life don't stop. Like it keep, there's one event after another event. And at 14 and 15, you're not equipped to handle all those events back to back to back. And so eventually I just dropped out of school at like 15, in my 11th grade, I just dropped out of school, gave up on the band and really just focused on being in the streets. At some point you just, you know, for me, I just gave up. I was like, yo, this is my life. There's no purpose. There's no point in me being anything other than, you know, a street dude. You know, this is it for me. And so how do I become the best version of this? And that was my life. That was my story. And I believed in it. And so, you know, you accepted the fact that we're going to probably get shot, which I wound up doing. You're going to probably go to jail. You probably get hacked up by the police. You know, all these things happen. And so I think at that point, because I didn't really value my life, outside of being anything other than this, I accepted the end result. And because I knew one day would be my day, it was like, all right, let's just have the most fun we can have while we doing this thing till we gone.
And so you ended up getting arrested and going to prison when you were like 16 on an attempted murder charge, right? Like, how did that all play out?
I was dating this female. Like, on the weekends, I used to go get a, we would get like a hotel, really a motel, not a hotel. We would get like a motel. And that was my way of having like a safe haven. And I remember one weekend, she just called me early. We would go like on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then that weekend, I would go in and we would, you know, smoke weed, we would watch TV, we'd chill. And I would like break my drugs down for the weekend. I'd give us some bread, we'll go shopping, nothing crazy, like some Nike, stuff like that. And one weekend she called me and she was like, yo, because her mom was on drugs too. And she was like, my mama tripping, man. I just won't get out of the house because you come get me at that time. I'm like, all right, bet. So I got me a little rock rental and I went to go get her. We went to the hotel early and her brother and sister wanted to come. And so I was like, all right, no problem, because I hadn't stayed in the motel so many times. I had got me another room. Mind you, I'm 16. So I got two rooms with connecting doors. I remember her brother and them saying it was hungry. And I was like, all right, bet, let's go. Because I'm like a man child. It was one of my favorite books, Man Child in the Promised Land. I remember saying, all right, bet. So I remember going to the Chinese store. When I leave the Chinese store, I got a handful of stuff, so I leave my gun in the car. And her little brother knocks on the door. And as soon as he knocks on the door, somebody grabbed me in. They put the Mac 11 to my head. They threw me on the bed. Her brother and her sister ran. She in the bed. And I was just, damn. All right, this is how it's about to go down. All right, cool. Yeah. I remember them just like, where the weed at, where the drugs at, where the money at. And I remember me like, man, I don't even got nothing. But it's crazy because, again, I didn't value my life as so much. I remember looking like, oh, because I had done did so much stuff in the street. I was like analyzing him like, yo, he playing me too close with this pistol. I can easily like take the gun, shoot him. You know, like I'm going through this in my head, like, yo, because I done did this before. And so I'm on the other side of it. And I'm like, yo, he ain't no professional. But right before I was going to make whatever move I thought I was going to make, she was like, boy, it ain't worth your life. And then she was just like, the drugs right here. And the money right there. And the dude was like, man, I should blow your effing brains out right now off of playing with me. And I just remember being like shocked and betrayed all at once. And I remember them getting it. Running out the hotel, and I remember running out of my car to get the gun. I remember being broad day, like I shot the gun like 5 times. And I went back to the room and I was like, yo, why the hell would you do that? And she was like, boy, you was about to lose your life on some guns, some drugs. That don't even make no sense. I'm like, well, how the hell did they know I was here? And so at that point I knew she hadn't like set me up. So, you know, I found out who it was because just in the hood, you know, you can't let that slide. And at that point, if you let that slide, then you become fair game. You know, you become fair game for everybody that's hurting. You become fair game at the dice game. You become fair game on the corner. You become fair game at the corner store. You become fair game at the club. You become fair game because the word travel. And so at that point, you got to just, you know, you got to regulate. You got to represent yourself. And so I found out who he was. Found out his set, which wasn't far from me. By 11 o'clock at night, I just went and ran down on him while they were shooting dice. Shot a little situation up, hit him 6 times. Got some drugs, got my money back. About 3 days later, I got arrested for something stupid. And then wound up getting connected to that. And I just cobbed out on it. I knew I couldn't fight it. He wound up coming to court, pointing me out. And I was like, I can't fight this, but one of my aunts found that I was in jail fighting a charge, and she knew the judge, Judge L.Y. He just passed away maybe last year, and he wound up letting me go with 10 years. And that was that was the birth of something new, you know?
So was it common for people to get tried as an adult for something like that?
And violence is heavy in New Orleans. But I remember being in prison. I remember being fighting that charge. And I remember seeing like a lot of dudes my age on similar charges, whether it was attempt murder, whether it was armed robbery, whether it was on kidnapping or carjacking. And so, yeah, they charge you as an adult. That was kind of new to me because in my mind, I thought I was going to be tried as a juvenile.
Right.
I'll get home at 21, I'll be all right. But when they sent me across the street, they were like, nah, you're being tried as an adult. I was like, oh, okay. It's new. You know what I'm saying? And I ain't going to lie. Again, I was scared in that situation too. You know, I ain't never been in this type of situation before. Which is one of the reasons why I'm so heavy on what I do right now is because so many people that come from what I come from, that's a typical story. It's not a far-fetched story. It's not like, dang, you've been through a lot. It's like, no, you go to where I'm from, there's like six other people. Like, oh yeah, my brother been locked up since he was 16 too. Or my cousin was locked up when he was 16 too. Like, it's such a common story. So that's why it's important for me right now to be doing what I'm doing, because I want to paint a narrative about something that's different. I feel like if I would have had exposure to different tools, different equipment, different education, different possibilities from somebody that looked like me, come from where I come from, I think it would have been easier for me to, I don't know, walk away. But when you don't see too many, when you don't see that opportunity, when you don't see those different avenues, you know, you settle for that in which you see the most.
So what specifically do you think you would have needed for you to be convinced to take a different path in your life as a kid?
Something other than what I did see. Because everybody don't turn to the streets. If I would have had, like, even having a father in my life probably would have changed things for me. Having a big brother, somebody to show me that, you know, the streets ain't it. You know, even if my OGs would have had a different perspective. But again, in most situations, everybody's only reacting to what they have. They're accepting the reality that's around them, you know, that has overwhelmed them. And so you need something different. You need somebody to show you something different. It can't just be go work a job. Because most people you see working a job, they're struggling. You know what I'm saying? That was in my environment at the time. We talking 90s, late 90s, mid to late 90s. They struggling. They barely making it. They, you know, so that wouldn't have been it. It's just, I don't know, man. It's just something to give me other than just being consumed by it. Like, I woke up to it. I walked through it every day. I went to sleep with it on my mind. I've been toting a gun since I was 13. Like, it consumed me. And so whatever consumes you at least that early in age, where you still don't even understand how to walk through life. I'm 13. I don't know how to navigate life. You know what I'm saying? But I'm put in a situation where, you know, it's human instinct to survive first. So what I will say is I appreciate my mama being so real with me, where I didn't get in this woe is me mode. I was angry, of course. I was alone, of course. But I knew it was necessary for me to survive. And that, at that point, that's the only thing that's on your mind, survival.
You mentioned that your story was similar to a lot of other people that you knew. But yet, when you went to prison, somebody came in and helped you make that shift. Like, what was it about this person? What was it about that time in your life while you were in prison that made you want to make this mindset shift?
Man, I think we always searching for something different. But I remember being in solitary confinement. I had 90 days for a fight I was in. I get in a cell with this white guy, man. I think he was just disgusted at what he saw. He was playing a game at a different level. Like, when I came into the cell, I remember him just being like, I don't mean no disrespect, bro, but y'all playing the wrong game. You ain't gonna never leave this shit. And I remember just being like, what? And because my energy was still high, I just come from fighting my homies. Like, I was like, nah, I'll beat your ass up in here, man. And he was like, nah, man, no disrespect. He was so cool with his approach. Like, he disengaged the animosity. You know what I'm saying? And he was just like, and I was like, man, you ain't here for me. So what the hell are you talking about? And he just went to telling me, like, you got to stop trading time for money. You got to stop working so hard for money. You got to learn how to give value to people. And I remember me in prison, I had a red band. So a red band mean, like, in New Orleans, attempted murder, armed robbery, carjacking, kidnapping. It's a violent offense. And he had on a red and white band, which let us know he was in the feds. And so because I knew he was in the feds, you kind of understand for some reason in the criminal world, you think that's like a hierarchy or something. Like at young, you're like, oh, he in the feds. He might know something. He was in there for $2.8 million in embezzlement. He paid restitution on $800,000. He kept $2 million. And my mind was, let me lure the game you playing. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, I think that just, I had never even heard nobody mention $2 million. And so for him to show it to me in his paperwork, it's kind of mind blowing to me, because even none of the hustlers I knew had $2 million. You know what I'm saying? And so over the next 55 days, me and him being in a cell together, he just put me on so much stuff, man. Like stuff that I had never knew before. And I think that was kind of like a seed that was planted for me in prison around investing.
So you end up being taught by this guy all about financial literacy and investing and how to have a different view on money. How did you begin to like change your thought processes about how life was supposed to be? How did you begin to change your relationship with your emotions and violence and everything else that has also led to you becoming as successful as you are now?
It didn't happen all at once. And he really didn't even teach me like financial literacy. I think he just planted a seed that the dope game was stupid. I think he just planted a seed that if you don't do something different, you're going to stay here. And I remember him distinctively telling me, you got 10 years. For chump change, I got 18 months for $2.8 million, and if I come back, the most I can ever get was probably 5 or 10. If you come back, you'll probably get 20 to whatever, but you might come back for something worse off than what you're in here for. Not so you may never see the streets again. And I remember that just was like, damn, like, ain't right, because I knew so many people already that didn't make it. So he hit home. But I remember, you know, so that just kind of planted the seed in my head. And then he just told me like three things that wealthy people do, you should do is invest in stocks, invest in a business, and then invest in real estate. And so when I went to, you know, I was inspired by the 2.8 million. I remember going upstate and the first book I read was Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I'm lying. The first book I read was Coldest Winter Ever. And the next book I read was Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And I remember those two books having so much impact on my life, because Rich, Sister Soldier and Coldest Winter Ever was a deep reflection of my life from, you know, the characters and the things that was going on around there. And then I remember Robert Kiyosaki. I was like, damn, like this is a different game for real. And when I started watching the stock market on TV in prison, it just started reminding me so much of the streets. It wasn't a different game. They just played by some of the different rules. But the game was the same. Good product, market it, sell it, brand it. If people front you something, give me money back. Credibility. It reminded me so much of the streets, but what they did. Like if somebody paying terrorists, that means that's the equivalent of I can go on your block and hustle, but only if you pay me draft. That's all a terrorist is. When we think about what terrorists are, you can sell stuff in this country or that country, but what's the price you're going to pay to come sell here? That's what tariffs are. You know what I'm saying? So for me, it was like, okay, you want to hustle in this hood? You're going to have to pay me. And if you don't pay me, you can't hustle here. I was like, oh, this is the same god dang on thing. This ain't nothing changed right here, right? Whoever got the best product, Apple got good product. Amazon got good product. The better your product, the more demand. If you can meet supply and demand, you're good. Ain't nothing different than streets with that. You know what I'm saying? As an investor, you don't want to sell all your, you don't want to use all your money. You want to make sure you got re-up money so you can buy more. Don't spend all the profit. Same thing as investing. Same thing in the streets. You won't have re-up money, right? You spend your re-up money, how you going to get some more product to put back on the street? It was the same principles. And I was like, oh, this is where the real gangsters play ball at right here. And they ain't going to jail. They ain't risking their life. They just keep selling more product.
And so how long had you been in jail at this point when you started talking to this guy? I'm always on the lookout to keep my immune system strong while I travel, juggle multiple businesses, and manage my stress. I noticed that some of my friends were using an incredible product called Armor Colostrum, so I decided to give it a try. To be fully transparent, I haven't been using it for that long. However, I've been on the road a lot since starting it, and I haven't been sick at all. Armor Colostrum is a proprietary concentrate of bovine colostrum that harnesses over 400 functional nutrients to strengthen your immune barriers, your body's inside suit of armor, and first line of defense against harmful particles from the environment that can trigger inflammation and make you sick. So essentially, it can strengthen your immunity, ignite your metabolism, fortify gut health, promote hair growth, and power fitness performance and recovery. As someone who hates being sick and works out every day, I certainly feel more confident now that I'm taking Armor Colostrum. So together, Armor and I have worked out a special offer for my audience so that you can receive 15% off your first order. Go to tryarmor.com/Doug or enter Doug to get 15% off your first order. Again, it's tryarmor.com/Doug or enter Doug to get 15% off your first order. That's tryarmor.com/Doug. Now back to the show.
Now, I had probably been in there a year and a half, but then he left because we was in a Harris jail. So I got shipped to prison and he got shipped to federal prison. So we separated. I probably was in the jail about a year. I was probably 17, 18 when I bumped heads with him. And then I remember when I got upstate, you know, just reading. I got turned on to reading when I was in prison. And I remember I was running numbers. Kind of like how FanDuel and fantasy football and stuff is. I was doing that in 2001. And I remember my ticket name was Braveheart. And I remember I used to get the USA Today, but a friend of mine named Chris Kellogg used to get USA Today. And he used to tell me, you watch CNBC on TV, but when you get the USA Today from me, all you get is the sports section. Why you don't read the business section? I was like, man, ain't nothing for me to read up. And now you're like, you buying a paper, but you is missing the best part. I was like, what? And I remember him showing me the USA Today, the finance, the business section, when they talking about stocks. And I was like, oh, this is good. And so Chris Kellogg put me on that. And I remember he was a UConn fan. I was a Duke Blue Devil fan. So we used to always be beefing about stuff at that time. But that was another turn on. So it put me on, you know, me looking at Robert Kiyosaki, me looking at USA Today, me looking at the stock market, like it all came full circle for me.
And so how did your overall outlook on life like shift throughout your time in prison? Because you mentioned that you were in solitary confinement for fighting. Like did that the violence continue or after you met this guy and you started talking to your friend Chris and you started reading, did your behavior and outlook change?
Not necessarily. Because I was still in prison. And so the rules of engagement stayed the same in prison. The rules of engagement didn't change. But I did start focusing more on like how to make money. You know what I'm saying? Like that was like the goal was still how to make money. And the goal was how do I turn my street money into stock market money? That was the goal. Because in my heart, I was still going to go back to the streets. So, I mean, I wasn't actively looking for stuff to get into, but I started creating different little businesses so I can have more money. I started washing clothes because I worked in the laundry. So like getting people clothes white, that's a hustle in the laundry, in the prison, like making sure you got white clothes. So I had that hustle, and that hustle was bringing me probably like $1,000 a month or more. So that was good. Then I had my ticket business in prison. I used the laundry money to fund my ticket business. And the ticket business was just like FanDuel is right now. And I had tickets on 4 units. And so, you know, it kind of put that mindset in me. Like, yo, you still hustling. We can still be hustling. So my temperament was still the same because I was still in that box. Now, when I came home, I changed a little bit, but I still was in the streets. My mindset was, are we going to turn this street money, stock market money?
When did you finally make the decision to walk away from the streets and go all in on what you're doing now?
I had been learning when I came home. I had been learning a lot. I had been still into it. But I caught a charge, $10,000, 8 pounds of weed, a 223, a 40 with extended clip and a beam, and 100 X pills. And I remember when the police came, kicked my door, but they had me in a car. And they brought me upstairs to my crib. I remember the stock market being on. And I remember the guy telling me, you got to be some kind of idiot to be selling drugs and listening to the stock market at the same time. And I ain't gonna lie, I remember just feeling so like stupid. Damn, you right. Goddamn police is right. It kind of pissed me off. It pissed me off because I fed into like what they thought of me. And I knew I was smarter than that. And so I remember getting found not guilty on the charge because of what's called fruit of a poisonous tree. Is when they kick your door in or they get something on you, but they don't have a search warrant for it because they had me, they kicked in the door and everything, but they didn't get the search warrant until 2 hours later. That was a seed planted in me that knew I didn't have long, but it wasn't until me and my homie went hit a lick. Cause we just started like, all right, well, I'm not gonna be hustling no more, but I got something real crafty for the ass now. So I remember me and my homies used to start robbing drug dealers after that. And like, if they won't see us, they can see us in the street. You know what I'm saying? Again, still really no value on my life. And then I remember in that lick, one of us almost got killed. And my homie saved my life. And I remember telling him after that, like, dog, I'm good. Cause at this point, I done did 10 years, I done beat a charge. Got past another near-death experience. That's my time to bow, gracefully. Now, anytime you lose, like, your instinct and you start thinking about what's going to happen, you know, what's the consequences behind doing said things, you realize that it's time for you to get out. Because the lion never thinks about the hyena biting him when he's going to hunt. Like, yo, I'm going to bite the ass back. So that was kind of my... I just was like, all right, let's just go all in on this shit.
How did you deal with temptation early on to go back to your old patterns?
I think for me, I'm real strong-minded. So once I make the decision that I ain't going to do something no more, it's done. I don't really like kind of like, that's like I made the same decision to stop smoking, stop drinking. I don't do it. You know what I'm saying? So like, I just understood it. But then I wound up having my daughter in 2016 and I was like, yo, she don't deserve to ever come see me behind bars. She never deserved that. And the reason why I say she never deserved that because I remember being in prison and seeing like one of my partners who was on a double murder charge he had. They gave him life and something else. And I remember him saying like, damn, bro, like I'll never see my daughter as a free man. And we had already been down like 5 years at the time. And he got his girl pregnant. Like his daughter was born while he was in prison. And so we was already 5-6 years in. He was like, damn, dog, like I'm watching my daughter grow up behind these bars. I'll never see her from here outside of this. And that kind of dawned on me heavy when I had my daughter. I was like, nah, she don't deserve that version of me. You know what I'm saying? She don't deserve that version of me. And so, and she deserves a dad that's always here because my dad wasn't ever there for me. So everything I didn't have, I was like, yo, she deserves better than that. And I haven't looked back since 2015 on the streets.
I want to talk about like how you've dealt with the collateral damage. You mentioned that you're in therapy now to help you deal with anger and the emotions. I've heard you talk about like you have some issues with abandonment and trust. Like I think I heard you say that you, whenever you go to like a random girl's house or somebody you don't really know, you text people the address just to be sure in case you're like getting kidnapped or something. I think I saw that. With all that said, like
good homework right now, man. Yeah, man.
Like how are you doing with all this?
That's true, man. Whenever I'm dealing with somebody, I always text my homies where I'm at. I'm still working through it, brother. I ain't gonna lie to you. I'm still working through it. Because I was in the street longer than I've been legit. And I've experienced more stuff from that lifestyle than I have, you know? And so I think the biggest goal for me was dealing with just being there for my daughter 100%, like being there for her and showing up for her emotionally. And that, a byproduct of that was being emotionally available. So I needed therapy for that. But I'm still struggling in my dating life because, you know, just from abandonment and, you know, that situation where I almost lost my life being set up. So I'm still working on that because the same thing kept showing up over and over again. Like I'll get to a certain point and then I'd be like, nah, I'm good. Because that required me to be vulnerable and vulnerability hurt me a few times. And so I'm still working on that. If I'm being honest with you, I'm still working on that. And I'm also still working on that. You don't have to be as aggressive with people. You know what I'm saying? Because nobody in this business that I'm in is out to kill me. I don't got to watch out for nobody trying to, you know, backdoor me or nothing like that. So I'm still working through it. I ain't gonna lie to you, but I'm working through it in a great way. As far as I'm consistently moving forward, I'm acknowledging when I'm feeling certain ways. I'm acknowledging, hey, bro, that you don't live like that no more. You're tripping. So I'm still working on that, and it's gonna take some time. But I give myself grace.
There's a lot of people that feel trapped in their circumstances, whether they're in prison or not. And they don't know how to get out. They see no way out. And not everybody is as fortunate as you to have that guy come along at probably one of the darkest times of your life to help give you some guidance on how to change your life moving forward. Like, what's your advice to people that like still feel trapped and they can't see the light at the end of the tunnel?
If I'm being completely honest, the only limitations we have in life is the ones that we put on ourselves. So I think the biggest goal is to, you know, don't allow this temporary situation to be a permanent destination for you, whatever that situation is. Because even when you get out of that situation, more things are going to happen. But what I would say is look at where you've been at, look at where you are now, and look at how many times you overcame, like, tragic situations. This ain't your first time overcoming something. And that's the reality is. And I think we use the things that we've overcame as momentum to move further, then that helps us. Because even right now in my life, one of the things I consistently do when things get hard, I look back on those dark days. I look back on those days when I was on an air mattress. I look at 2018 when me and my daughter was on an air mattress together. I look at the days when I slept in the van door and I say everything I've been through is preparing me for something great. And so now that I'm here, I'm like, yeah, like I can look back at those situations and be like, yo, that prepared me for this. So where we are today is a byproduct of what we've done in the past. So if you want to change your future, then you got to change where you're at right now. And I think that's digging deep in yourself. There's no magic pill you can take that make this go away. Right? Like it's a day by day grind. You eat an elephant one bite at a time. So it's every day you just show up for yourself and you just demand more yourself than anybody else's expectation can ever be. You know what I'm saying? I know that might sound like, man, I'm hurting right now. But if you think you're hurting, if you think there's no way out, then there isn't. The one thing I will say is even though I didn't value my life, even though I didn't I always thought I was going to be the biggest dope dealer ever. And that shit was inspirational to me. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? That shit was inspirational to me, man. Like, we're going to be a kingpin, dog. You know what I'm saying? We're going to sell all the dope in New Orleans. And so it was inspiration to me. And it may not sound like the best thing to say, but no matter how dark things got for me, like, I used that to be better. So even when things pivoted for me, I now look at myself like, I'm like, yo, we gonna put this as a public company one day. That's definitely would be something I would say to fuel that fire in somebody right now.
People also get trapped in the victim mindset along those same lines where you kind of mentioned that you were like, you know, I hated God because you were like, I did nothing and look at my circumstances that, you know, he gave me. How did you begin to like shift yourself out of that mindset so that you could start taking full responsibility and not blaming your circumstances or God or whoever for the life that you had?
I think because my grandmother like raised me in church, that's kind of why I was so rebellious in God in that moment. But I still, even in those moments, it wasn't that I was down on myself. I just didn't rock with God. You know what I'm saying? In that time, like I wasn't, that's the one thing I've never been is like a Debbie Downer. I've never played life from the victim mode. Because my mama, I just installed that in me. Like whatever you want in life, you got to go get it. And sometimes you might got to do it by hook or crook. You know what I'm saying? Like sometimes you got to grind it out. And again, it's, as you get older, you start developing the instructions for your own life. But I was only basing my life off the instructions that I had at that age. Right. So it was nobody ain't come save me. All right, cool. But I don't want to hear about God right now. I don't want to talk about God. I don't want to talk about religion. I don't want to talk about grace. I don't want to talk about prayer. I don't want to talk about blessings because look where the hell I'm at. I'm going to get me out of this situation. But now when I think back about it, like I look at it like God gave me so much grace. You know what I'm saying? So I think, you know, as James Allen would say, as a man think it. You know what I'm saying? That's come from something in the Bible as well. As a man thinketh, so is he in his heart. But I just think that in my heart, like I say, like I always had these big ass aspirations for myself. And I just felt like what I was going through was necessary for me to get where I needed to go. But I just didn't connect with God in that. Now, I think that's totally the wrong thing for somebody to do, but that's just my belief. I think you should always stay connected to God because that's how you get clarity on it. But also, I just feel like God had grace on my life because even through my blasphemous moments in life, he still looked out. He still blessed me. But I still put work and I still never gave up. I still, you know, I watched my grandmother and my mom really just grind. And so those characteristics and those traits were just in me for sure. The worst thing you can do is play victim on yourself and ask the world, you know, blame the world for where you at and woe is me, you know, because the pain is in discipline or the pain is in regret. You got to just choose which one you're willing to go through. And so I just chose to just keep going forward, man. It was going to hurt. And it couldn't get no lower than where I was.
You talked about being super strong-minded and you've talked about that how you've been able to just to do so much by yourself. You've been able to achieve so much. A lot of people that have been able to do what you've done in achieving things by themselves, or they've had people leave them and they couldn't count on them, they have a hard time reaching out and asking for help, especially guys. Guys have a really difficult time reaching out and asking for help, specifically with their mental health. What was going on in your life that led you into seeking like therapy? Was there a specific event or was it just like a buildup of stuff that had happened over the years?
And I still struggle with that. I ain't gonna lie to you. I still struggle with asking for help. But it's always I'm always in a situation to push my pride to the side because I know in order to do something I've never done, I'm gonna need people who can outthink me, people who are smarter than me. When it came to mental health, I gotta credit two people. One was Charlemagne the God. I heard him talk a lot about like black mental health. And I didn't even know a such thing as existed because again, coming from where I come from, the only time you go see a therapist is if your mom is trying to get a check for you or something. Somebody trying to get you a check. Somebody trying to get you an SSI check or something. So I really wasn't really on it. I got on it over the last couple of years. I found a good one now. The second one is the female I was dating before. She was such an amazing woman. but I battled with the anxiety, the residue of my past so much. I would show up because I knew what she deserved, but I wouldn't show up emotionally because I was trying to get away. I would show up and I would do stuff for her birthday, not because emotionally I was there, but because I understood she was a great woman. But at nighttime, we would land in the bed together, I would be literally like having anxiety attacks on abandonment issues. I don't want to be here. It was hard for me to just be with her. But I would show up for her. I would support her. I would do all kind of stuff because I know she was such an amazing woman. And then one day I just was like, yo, I took her on a birthday trip. I remember saying to her when we came back, I was like, man, I can't do this. She was like, what? I was like, man, I can't even sleep at night. And I realized that if I don't go to therapy, I'm going to be broken forever. And I don't know what this is going to do for me and you. I asked her to let me, you know, go handle this. But I did. I told her, but I do want to tell you thank you because I really know I need therapy. I really know I need to talk to somebody about these issues. I really need to talk to somebody about my mama abandoning me, how that made me feel. My grandmother passing away, how that made me feel. I need to talk about how I felt when I got shot and nobody was at the hospital. I need to talk about how I felt when I was in prison and barely getting letters from my people. I need to talk about what it felt like to go to trial and nobody was there. I need to talk about what it felt like to shoot a man. How does that feel? I need to talk about those things instead of just coping with them. And I think now with therapy, I just get to talk about them. And my therapist helps me look at things from different perspectives. Because when we start to store that trauma, it starts to eat away at us. I'm still a black man with 4 head of hair. You know what I'm saying? So I'm thankful for that year. So my trauma hasn't eaten me up too bad yet. So it was between listening to people like Charlamagne and Guy and the last woman I was dating that really, really made me anchor down on therapy.
You listed out like multiple things there that even one of those would be super traumatic for somebody to go through. Like how have you, there were so many things that you just talked about that I'm sure have just stacked on top of each other. Like how have you began to like reconcile all that and all the emotions that go with it?
I think we just go through it day by day, session by session. I remember my therapist said, yo, this is going to be hard because you're going to have some deep conversations. And I said, man, I'd have been shot at and shot. Talking to you about how I'm feeling ain't nothing hard about that. <That's funny. laughs> I was like, talking to you about what I got going on ain't nothing hard about that, man. So, and I think that gave him permission to ask some of those deep diving questions and us having those conversations. So, like, for instance, you know, the guy that I shot, for me and him, I think the trauma behind that was I still dealt with seeing him on the ground bleeding. I still dealt with some nights having nightmares of being shot down my damn self. And my therapist, one of the things we talked about was just like forgiving myself. And I think that's something that we don't talk about a lot is just like forgiving yourself for some of the stuff that you've done based on the situation we was in. And I use this reference, like a lion ain't gonna never feel bad for biting a goddamn hyena head off. You know what I'm saying? Because that's the rules of engagement in the jungle. But when you put him in the zoo, there's not a lion got time to think about it. You put him in the zoo long enough, you put him around a hyena again, he might just look at him and go about his business. You know what I'm saying? He may be the one to get attacked because now what he had that made him so ferocious that he ain't that no more. And I think for me, that's kind of how I was. Like, I wasn't out here looking for nothing, but I was ready to entertain anything. And I think now that I have more to lose, I have more at stake. I got more people depending on me. I have 13 people that work with me building my business. I have my mama that's depending on me. I pay her bills. My daughter, mom, I take care of them. I got family members I take care of. I got people that I inspire. Like, I got more to me to lose, but also, I think that situation for getting me where I am, it was a necessary evil, which is why he didn't die. Because then I would be fighting a murder charge and he probably can't come home from that. You know what I'm saying? So, we have so many dope conversations when we talk about that and just helping me look at stuff from different perspectives. And I think that in itself is a form of healing. But also, I think I'll never feel like I'm healed because I've been through so much in my life. I think it's just going to be an everyday commitment to me on just being a better thing. Also having mentors like Eric Thomas around, men who I look up to, men who I inspire as positive, because for a lot of my life, I just looked up to gangsters and dope dealers, murderers, drug dealers. So even changing the people that I look up to and admire is a big thing for me. All of that's part of my journey right now.
How do you talk to your daughter about your past?
I don't. Not yet. She's only 8. But there's a time, you know, she knows I've been to prison. I've never lied to her about that. She knows I've been to prison. And honestly, I think it's cool because me and her have such amazing conversations. And I know there'll be a time where we'll have to dig deep into it. And I don't mind telling her that. I'm so compassionate when it comes to her and being a dad. But there'll be a day where we'll talk about a lot of my background and what daddy been through. But she knows I've been to prison. And I've never hid that from her. But I don't think I also don't think I need to go in detail about what I went to prison for. But I have talked to her about me going to prison. I have talked to her about me not knowing my father. I have talked to her about, you know, daddy being homeless before, which is why we have gratitude and which is why we're so thankful for the way we live now. This is why we don't look down on people, nobody. And I think those things help me pour into her and have a different perspective on life for her, which also helps her become a better human being.
Other than not repeating the pattern of your parents, what's your favorite thing about being a dad?
Right now, it's soccer practice.
I see you posting about it.
Right now, right now it's soccer, man. She's in soccer, and I'm so enthusiastic about it. But more than anything, my favorite part about being a father is the love that she gives me. I've never felt that type of love before, man. And it's infectious. Like, I could be going through a lot in the business world, and just seeing her changed my perspective. A hug from her, a call from her changed my perspective. She's 8. She's so super intelligent. And so I think my favorite part about that is just actively being hurt. I always tell her that I need her more than she needs me. I'm like, you know, I need you more than you need me. And it's because the more I look at her, the more I just realize why I can never go back to where I come from. You know, the more I look at her, the more I realize how much I have to keep becoming better, how much I got to keep evolving, why therapy is worth it. You know what I'm saying? Why me being the best version of myself is worth it, because I want her to always be like, yo, I watch my dad evolve. And so knowing that I got that little person that's looking up to me and that's watching me and that's loving me, I think that's probably the best part of being a father.
I love it, man. What a way to close and bring things full circle. And man, I wanted to thank you for sharing your heart, being vulnerable, and just sharing everything on the pod. I think the audience is going to love this. If people want to connect with you, they want to learn more, man, where's the best place to do that?
So, you know, on Instagram, wall_street_trapper. We on YouTube, Wall Street Trapper. We got a show come out every 2 to 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern time on the Wall Street Looks Like Us network. So definitely, man, tap in. And I hope I can help as many people as I can on my journey, whether it's through investing or whether it's just inspiration from looking at my life and seeing how far I came and letting them know that they can do it too. Thank you for having me too, man. I know we've been working to get this here, you know what I'm saying? So I appreciate your patience with me. I be moving around a lot. So I just want to tell you, thank you for that too, man.
You got it, man. It was definitely worth the wait. And thanks again for taking the time.
Oh, man. Thank you, brother.